To whom or to what have you given your allegiance? I'm a big believer in the old line, everybody's got to serve somebody. So where have you put your trust, your allegiance, your faith? One of the easiest ways of reflecting upon a question like this, of reflecting upon our allegiance, is to consider where we turn for reassurance or for safety. In a chaotic world, a world with uncertainty at every turn, where do we find stability? Where do we find hope? Now, we often think that our world, our time, is particularly sort of filled to overflowing with chaos and confusion. And I suppose in a sense it is. Gunmen opening fire on a bus of innocent people, ancient cities laid to ruin by civil war, tensions over race and politics and religion breaking out in violence all over the world. Millions of people, most of them children, ravaged by heartbreaking poverty while the rich wear single pieces of clothing that cost enough to buy a family a home. The chaos can at times feel overwhelming indeed. Of course, there's another sense in which this is just kind of business as usual. I mean, has there ever been a time in our history, in the history of the human race, where the rich have not oppressed or abused the weak? Has there ever been a time without violence? Has there ever been a time without war or without poverty or without injustice? The letter that we call the Book of Revelation, it's a letter that was sent to some churches, was likely written during just such a time for the earliest Christians, a time of chaos and violence. Now, the book is very hard to date, but it seems likely, and I think, that it was written in the last half of the first century, so sometime between 50 and 100 AD, and probably in the 90s AD, that's what I think. And I think that's what Pastor Terry thinks too. When Rome, at this time Rome, the Empire of Rome, dominates the known world, politically speaking. The great Caesar Domitian ruled in the 90s. He ruled over an empire that stretched from Persia in the east to Africa in the south to northern Europe in the north and dominated every aspect of life around the Mediterranean Sea and beyond. And when I use the word great, when I'm talking about Domitian, don't hear good, necessarily, or moral. Domitian was a tyrant, by all accounts, a domineering and authoritarian ruler who worked very hard to create stability in his empire. And he did this by using threats of violence, by using lots of actual violence, and through widespread economic, political, and religious manipulation. Also, he thought that he was a god, so there's that. Or maybe, no, if not a god, then at least a descendant of a god. Or I think his sister was made a god as well. So there's some god stuff happening here too. This is the world into which John writes the book of Revelation, a world of stability and safety for the insiders and a world of terror and violence for the outsiders. And interestingly, when we think about the church at this time, we generally think about Christians as outsiders. But actually, that was kind of an active question facing the church in these years. Would they be insiders or outsiders? Would they do what was necessary to appease Domitian's Roman Empire, or would they oppose it and make themselves targets of it? In a very real sense, this is the question of the book of Revelation. But why am I talking about all this? Why am I talking about Rome? Rome's not even mentioned in Revelation chapter 17, right? Well, okay. Let's read Revelation 17, and then we'll talk about what's going on in this really fascinating passage. So this is Revelation chapter 17. I'm reading out of a translation called the Lexham English Bible, which is a bit of an out-of-the-way translation. If you've got an electronic Bible, you should have it. If not, just follow along with whatever you have. You should be able to sort of track, I think. Revelation chapter 17. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke to me, saying, "Come." And me here, by the way, is John. "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed sexual immorality, and those who live on the earth became drunk with the wine of her sexual immorality. And he carried me away into the wilderness of the Spirit, and I saw a woman seated on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. holding a cup in her hand full of detestable things and the unclean things of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of all the detestable things of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. And I was greatly astonished when I saw her. And the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that has the seven heads and the ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is going to come up from the abyss, and he is going to destruction. And those who live on the earth, whose names are written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast that was and is not and will be present. Here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other is not yet come, and whenever he comes, it is necessary for him to remain a short time. And the beast that was and is not and is also himself an eighth, and is of the seven, and he is going to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they will receive authority as kings for 1 hour with the beast. These have one opinion, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and crowds and nations and languages. And the ten horns that you saw and the beast, these will hate the prostitute and will make her desolate and naked, and they will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. For God put into their hearts to carry out his purpose and to make a unanimous decision to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city and has sovereignty over the kings of the earth." This is the word of the Lord. So, I mean, I don't even know why you need me. That's pretty straightforward, right? I mean, I just... Just read it, man. Okay, this is a difficult passage. There's a lot of very strange things happening here. Fair warning, I'm not getting to all of them. That's not in the cards today, okay? There's just too much to deal with, and we don't have enough time. I'm going to try and sort of hit the key points in this passage. So to begin, the passages that immediately precede Revelation 17, so chapters 15 and 16, if you remember from last week when Terry was preaching, these are all about God's judgment. And they end with the cup of God's wrath being consumed by Babylon, which leads to the destruction of Babylon. And that's kind of where we pick up in chapter 17, this exact topic, the fall of Babylon the Great, it is called. Now, there's a very complex metaphor or set of metaphors being used here with many interlocking components, and we need to explore all of them. You can't really take these images apart into their component pieces very easily. What we need to do is we need to identify the relevant pieces, and then we need to talk about what they all mean together. This is one sort of big unified metaphor. It's really the only way we can make proper sense out of the metaphor of Babylon here. So what are the pieces? Let's just talk about the pieces for a second, and then we'll explore the pieces, and then we'll try to put them together. First, there's Babylon itself. And we're going to come back to this, but the first thing you have to know about Babylon is that Babylon ain't Babylon. Okay? Babylon is not, the word Babylon here is not a reference to the literal city of Babylon. The literal city of Babylon was an ancient city in southern Mesopotamia, what is modern-day Iraq. That's not what we're talking about here. Okay? So we're going to come back to that, but this isn't, Babylon ain't Babylon. That's our first piece. Second, Babylon is called a harlot or a whore. And there are a few sort of related pieces here that we'll explore. Sexuality, obviously, is part of this. But also money or economics. And then, strangely, but I'll explain this, religion is actually caught up in that metaphor. Third, we have the kings of the earth. The kings of the earth commit immorality with the harlot Babylon. This is related to political influence. Fourth, the harlot is seated upon a beast. Now, this beast is probably related to imperial power. We'll come back to that, too. The beast has seven heads and ten horns, which variously symbolize seven hills, seven kings, and ten kings. This is maybe the strangest bit of this composite image that we're dealing with, but it's related to geography, partially, and it's also related to political influence and political relationships. Now, finally, the woman and the beast, I guess, are seated upon many waters, it tells us. Now, this is related partly to economic power. It's a little bit about geography. And it's also related to power and influence with the common people. So those are all the pieces. Now, we're going to sort of touch on each of those pieces a little bit more fully, and then we'll try to put everything back together afterwards. So first, Babylon isn't Babylon. Though there has been some debate about this over the centuries, the majority of interpreters agree that Babylon here is probably a reference to the city of Rome. So why are we calling it Babylon? Why don't we just call it Rome? Well, the key issue here is an event that occurred in 586 BC. So 6 or 7 centuries before John saw his vision. In 586 BC, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, under the rule of King Nebuchadnezzar, attacked, besieged, and then conquered the city of Jerusalem. Destroyed the city, they destroyed the temple of God in the city. The Babylonians killed much of the populace of the city and the surrounding area, and they took many thousands of people captive into exile in Babylon. A couple of generations later, after the Babylonian Empire had fallen to the Persian Empire, because that's what happens to empires, they keep getting conquered by other empires, some of the people of Jerusalem were then allowed to return back to the city of Jerusalem to rebuild the temple of God, to rebuild the city. If you want to read about those stories, read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, and you can read about some of those things. The descendants of these people are the Jewish people, the people of Jesus. What we need to understand is that this event, the Babylonian exile, we call it, is perhaps the single most formative event in the Old Testament apart from the Exodus from Egypt. Almost all of the literature of the Old Testament is directly influenced by the exile. And huge portions of the Old Testament were either written during or as a result of the exile. The exile was such a profoundly foundational event in the consciousness of the Jewish people that it remained a defining cultural event right down to the time of Jesus. So centuries later. The Israelites and later the Jews came into contact with many other civilizations over the course of their histories, including some truly great empires like Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and now in our passage, Rome. Of these, interestingly, the Neo-Babylonian Empire was probably the smallest and the weakest by our standards in terms of political and military influence. But for the people of God, because of the profound intergenerational trauma that was caused by the siege and the destruction of Jerusalem, and especially the destruction of the Temple of God, Babylon was the enemy that eclipsed all other enemies. In the cultural memory of a first century Jew, and remember that in the first century, Christianity is still kind of a sect of Judaism, so in the cultural memory of first century Jews and Christians, Babylon was shorthand for violence and oppression and idolatry and evil. So when John has a vision of the horrors of Domitian's Rome, he calls it Babylon. And Babylon is a whore who seduces many kings, sits on a beast, and sits on many waters. The prostitution imagery is interestingly complex here. Of course, our minds go first to sex and to sexuality, which is a part of what's going on here, but it's only a part. As Eugene Peterson has noted, there is a clear and important difference between sex in a loving relationship and sex with a prostitute. In the latter, Peterson says, the coupling is sexual, but the relationship is commercial. This is a financial relationship. This image of Babylon as a harlot or a prostitute is partly a way of suggesting that Rome has seduced the other rulers of the world. But it's also a way of suggesting that this seduction is inauthentic. It's not real. It isn't about real devotion. It's about personal gain. The kings follow Rome because of the power that Rome gives to them. There's also another level to this metaphor that probably isn't obvious to us at all, and that is the religious dimension. As odd as it sounds to our modern Western ears, in the ancient world, there was a very close relationship between sexuality and religion. It was relatively common for certain temples to have prostitutes, both male and female, with whom worshippers could couple as part of the cultic rite at that temple. And this draws religious overtones into the image of the prostitute Rome. Here it's worth pointing out that Caesar Domitian was particularly well known for reviving and intensifying what we call the emperor cult. At different points in the history of Rome, like in the time of Domitian, the Caesar or his ancestors were worshipped as members of the pantheon of gods. And worshipping the empire became an act that was simultaneously religious and political. It's hard to get ahead in a society that worships its king if you don't also worship the king, right? There's sort of a glass ceiling for you there. Needless to say, this was a problem for Christians who thought that worshiping anybody but Jesus was idolatry. This is one of the conflicts that they have in front of him, which is mentioned in other parts of the letter, the churches in Revelation. So, to review quickly, we're halfway kind of done here. Babylon is Rome. Babylon is the harlot, which includes elements of seduction, political and economic manipulation, and religious power, and the promise of power and advancement by means of official state religion. Now, the harlot Rome is seated on a beast. The beast here, which is almost certainly an image that's being drawn from the book of Daniel, from Daniel chapter 7, where four terrible beasts come up out of the sea, is probably a metaphor for the empire of Rome itself. There's a lot of debate about this, but this is certainly what I think is happening here, that the beast is the empire itself, or maybe certain rulers of the empire of Rome. So the harlot is the city of Rome. The beast is greater Rome, in my mind. Because of its size and its complexity and its totalitarian government, the Roman Empire was kind of a hodgepodge of intersecting political and economic conflicts, right? So the city of Rome was its heart, but certainly not its only center of power. There's other things going on in terms of politics in Rome. One of the elements of this part of the metaphor that we see in chapter 17 is that eventually the various kings, the harlot, and the beast itself become mutually destructive. In its violence, in its violence and immorality, Rome carried the seeds of its own destruction within it, is what John is saying. So Rome and the beast are also seated upon seven hills. This is a pretty straightforward geographical reference to the city of Rome, which is historically located on seven hills around the River Tiber. Rome is also seated upon the waters. Again, this is partly just a geographical metaphor for Rome. The city is located on the River Tiber, very near to the Mediterranean Sea. But this is also interpreted in verse 15 to be the great sea of humanity over which the harlot rules. Like the kings and the beast, the sea of humanity, the common people, the everyday people, are part of the ultimate destruction of the harlot Rome. And then finally, we have the horns and the heads of the beast. Now, the frank truth is, interpreters have been more or less baffled by these numbers for centuries. Nobody really knows what they mean. Some people have tried to count specific rulers of Rome, which is tricky and it's very hard to get to the right numbers. Some people have tried to apply these numbers to some other period in later history, like the medieval age or even in our times, which I, in my mind, is a little bit like drawing a bullseye around an arrow that you've already shot. So I don't think that's a good interpretive strategy. I think we should avoid that. Adding to the trouble here is the fact that numbers in the book of Revelation are almost always symbolic. John loves numerology. He uses it everywhere. Craig actually mentioned this a little bit in his sermon a couple of weeks ago when he was talking about the 144,000 that are sealed, or the reference to the people of God. That's a good example. So let's just use this as an example of how much John loves numbers and playing with numbers. So 144,000, what the heck is that? Well, 144,000 is 12 times 12,000. And the number 12, well, there's 12 disciples of Jesus, right, 12 apostles. There's also 12 tribes in Israel. So the number 12 refers to people of God. And then 1,000, what's 1,000 about? Well, 1,000 is John's way of saying really, really big number, like lots and lots and lots, right? Just many, many, many. So if you have 12 times 12,000, well, it's a reference to this uncountable mass, this great multitude of the people of God that John refers to. So it's not a literal 144,000 people. It's a symbolic number. And he does this with other things, right? So seven represents perfection or completeness or wholeness. 10 seems to suggest greatness or bigness. 6 represents evil because it's like a deficient 7. So you have 7, you take away 1, you get 6. That's a bad number. 3 seems to be maybe a Trinitarian number. It may be a reference to the Trinity. 4 sort of represents a whole piece of something. And it goes on and on and on. I'm not going to get to all the numbers. There's so many numbers in Revelation. We won't talk about all of them. But what does it mean then that we have 7 heads and 10 horns? Well, heads are rulers. Okay, that's not a hard metaphor. Okay? And in the Old Testament, horns represent power and kingship. And so this seems to be a kind of symbolic way of referring to kings and powerful rulers in Rome and rulers of Rome. Now, it might refer to some historical rulers. It might refer to diverse political powers in John's time. I mean, frankly, it's just really hard to say. I'm sure that John has something or someone in mind particularly here, but even though we don't know exactly who he means, the implications of what he means are not very difficult to sort of figure out. The great harlot Rome, riding the beast of empire, will eventually be torn apart from within and from without. She will consume herself with her violence and political and economic schemes. So her rulers within and without will actually devour and destroy her. What we see when we explore the metaphor of Babylon the harlot is a critique of the great city of Rome. Rome is wicked, tyrannical, and oppressive like Babylon. Rome seduces, seeks to control all of the people and all of the nations around it, whether through political manipulations, economic maneuvering, or through the power of religion. But that control does not lead to real relationship or real leadership. It leads to something artificial, something like the relationship between a John and a prostitute, and only truly deluded people see love or devotion of any kind there. And Rome itself, though the center of the empire and its seat of power, will eventually be devoured by the very beast that it rides, by its allies, the heads and the horns. And all of this, Rome, John tells us, will be a source of pain and persecution for those who follow the Lamb that was slain, for the Christians. Now, I mean, there's a bit of a temptation to kind of leave things there. That was a lot, right? But, you know, we've read, and I think hopefully we've more or less understood some parts of this passage in its ancient context, against its ancient background. It's about Rome, right? And Rome is bad. But that's too simplistic. Babylon the Great is not merely historical Rome. It is all that Rome represents. And because of this, it is always, it always has been, it always will be, profoundly and immediately relevant to our lives. Rome is the promise of power, according to the terms of this world. Rome is power by means of political seduction. It says, follow me, listen to me, love me, and I will give you influence. Rome is power by means of economic stability. It says, follow me, listen to me, love me, and I will make you secure. I will supply all of your needs. Rome is power by means of military might. It says, follow me, listen to me, love me, and I will make you safe. Rome is power by means of religious and cultural manipulation. It says, follow me, listen to me, love me, and I will give you meaning and acceptance. And so we must realize that Rome is alive and well, right here and right now in Canada in 2017. There are many different kinds of idolatry in this world. When we talk about idolatry as Christians, we mean the act of giving your allegiance or your faith to somebody or something other than God. We could explore an almost infinite number of ways that this can happen, but Revelation 17 focuses our attention on a couple of principal ways that we are deceived. It focuses on the idols of political, economic, and military power. It focuses us on power as a tool for getting stuff done. What we're being warned against in Revelation 17 is the idol of power, the idol of Babylon. It's a potent idol. I mean, this is a serious temptation. Many, many Christians have fallen to the temptation to accomplish some good thing, some good end by using the tools of economic coercion or military invasion. I mean, what do you think the Crusades were? Right? Military invasion, an attempt to accomplish a purportedly good end. What do we think was happening in World War I when a whole bunch of, you know, sort of purportedly Christian nations, people who called themselves Christians, collectively butchered an entire generation of young men in the trenches of Europe? What do we think is happening when a politician promises that if we elect them, they will fix the economy or the morals of the nation, or the injustices faced by the weak. It is profoundly, intensely tempting to put our faith in this coercive power, believing that we will use it well. I mean, we're different, right? We're going to do this the right way where everybody else has failed. But Revelation gives us an alternative to Babylon. Revelation gives us the way of the Lamb who was slain. It's an interesting phrase, the Lamb who was slain. It refers to Jesus, of course. This is John's way of talking about Jesus. For John, Jesus is the Lamb of God, the one who willingly gave himself up as a sacrifice for others. You know how many times John uses that phrase, the Lamb who was slain, in the book of Revelation? He uses it 28 times. The book's got 22 chapters. I mean, how often do you got to say it, man? Over and over and over again, he says this. On every page of the book of Revelation, we are being invited to reflect on how what we are reading relates to the Lamb who was slain. Even where the Lamb is not referred to specifically, like in our passage, he must consistently and constantly be in our minds. So what do we see when we compare Babylon the Great with the Lamb who was slain? Well, first of all, we see not merely a difference of degree, as though the Lamb is different because he's God, and so he's just way, way more powerful than Babylon. No. We see a difference of kind, a difference of nature. The way of Jesus is the way of the Lamb, which is self-sacrifice, love, the way of apparent weakness. Nobody looks at a lamb and thinks, man, that's a scary lamb. That isn't a thing, right? I was out at Cabin Farms with my kids yesterday, and they have baby animals. They had a baby lamb there. Baby lambs are not in any way scary to anybody at all, ever, okay? This is the way of apparent weakness. The way of Babylon, on the other hand, the way of Babylon the Great, the harlot, is the way of power, the way of self-aggrandizement, the way of manipulation, the way of strength for the sake of strength. And the irony is, as the story unfolds, it is the followers of the way of the Lamb who actually do overcome. They actually are victorious because they hold unswervingly and intently to the path of the Lamb who was slain. Revelation 12 actually tells us how it is that they triumph. It says they triumph by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. By means of faithfulness, not by means of power. Revelation 13 tells us that those who take up the sword will fall by the sword, and that we are to remain faithful and follow the Lamb, to reject the way of Babylon, in other words. I said at the beginning that the people to whom John wrote originally, the early Christians in the Roman Empire, were being faced with a question. Would they follow the way of Babylon or the way of the Lamb? Would they put their trust in political alliances, or would they sacrifice to the emperor in order to gain social standing, or would they have faith that their wealth would keep them safe? These were live questions for them. John addresses seven churches at the beginning of the letter. First, notice that it's seven churches, which I like, because again, numerology. So there are seven literal churches in those cities he mentions, but it's not just to those churches. It's to all churches, everywhere. Some of those churches are doing well. They are commended to remain faithful. But some of them are not doing so well. They are warned that they are following a path that is not the path of the Lamb who was slain. All around us, and at every turn, we are promised safety and stability by means of power. These promises prey on our very real and very understandable desires and fears. The fear of losing one's job, the need for financial stability, that's a very real thing. That isn't pretend. We in this province have felt this fear in palpable ways over the last few years. Can't minimize this need. Just like we can't minimize the importance of our political differences. They matter. Or even the difficult decisions surrounding, will we go to war? Will we not go to war? These are very difficult decisions. I'm not suggesting that we bury our heads in the sand and ignore the culture in which we have been placed. But what I am suggesting is that our engagement with questions of economics or politics or the military should be driven by a totally different set of concerns than people who do not follow the Lamb who was slain. Speak a little bit more practically, at least for a moment. How do you know if you've allowed the power of Babylon to become your object of worship? Well, for example, if you can't have a conversation about politics without losing your temper, that's a bad sign. Okay, that's symptomatic of a problem. If you think that anybody who voted for party X or candidate Y is both a horrible person and an idiot, without ever listening to that person or ever engaging with that person, that's symptomatic of a serious problem. If you are filled, just filled with anxiety or fear when the economy stumbles or when your account balance isn't quite as flush as you'd like, that is symptomatic of a problem. If you look at a person from another country or ethnicity or religion and your reaction is fear or anger or violence, that's symptomatic of a serious problem. If you are devoted to your nation, whether the nation is Canada or any other nation, in a way that leads you to hate another person because they're not from your nation, your country, that is symptomatic of a serious problem. We are not called as Christians to be patriots of earthly kingdoms. We are called to be devoted citizens of the kingdom of God. We are not called to be wealthy or to be successful in the eyes of the people around us. We are called to be servants of all. We are not called to be power brokers. We are called to sacrifice ourselves, to love others in faithfulness. Revelation 17 reminds us of the seductive lure of worldly power, of the way of Rome, the way of Babylon the Great. And it reminds us that the way of power is also the path of destruction. In the end, the harlot and the beast are destroyed by each other. They are devoured by the very kings they created and sustained. Revelation teaches us that instead of following that destructive path, we should follow the way of the Lamb who is slain and work together with him, trusting him for the healing and redemption of his creation. That's the ultimate message, the ultimate conclusion of the book of Revelation. Pray with me. God of grace and love and glory, we are thankful that you have drawn us and are working constantly to draw us into relationship with you, to help us to resemble you more closely, to be challenged to follow you, like the young man in the dream that Tim mentioned to us, that you are coaxing us towards yourself to follow you. Grant, as we reflect upon the words of your scripture, that you will give us the ability to differentiate between the lure of external power and worldly power and your call to follow you, the Lamb who was slain. Work in our hearts to draw us closer to you through this process. I pray these things in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.